Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome, everyone. Today we're diving deep into a truly monumental work, arguably the cornerstone of Chinese classical fiction, Cao Zhuying's Dream of the Red Chamber. You might also know it as The Story of the Stone.
It really is the pinnacle, and there's just so much. There are hundreds of characters, this incredibly detailed world.
Exactly. And our goal today really is to explore how this vast novel works on, well, multiple levels. It's this amazing blend of minute domestic realism, but also profound philosophical allegory, and maybe crucially a social critique, too.
That's right. And you can't really get the full impact without understanding the author, Cao Zhuying. He wasn't just an outside observer. This story was deeply personal.
His own life story is woven in.
Absolutely. His family was incredibly prominent, you know, serving the king court, immense wealth, and then they just crashed. A huge political reversal, loss of status, poverty.
So the decline of the Jia family in the novel, that's not just a plot device.
Not at all. It's very much a reflection, maybe semi-autobiographical, of his own family's fall from grace. That feeling of loss, the nostalgia for something magnificent that's gone, it's palpable because he lived it.
Wow. Okay. That has a whole layer of meaning right there.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't Cao play with this idea of reality and fiction right from the names?
He does, quite deliberately. Though the main family's name, Jia, Cao, sounds exactly like the word for false or fictional.
Jia. False, okay.
And then there's this other prominent family, the Zens, whose name is a homophone for real or true.
So right away he's telling you, question what seems real here. Illusion versus reality.
Exactly. It's a central theme woven into the very fabric of the story from the beginning.
Okay, so let's trace that thread. Where does the story actually begin? Not with the family drama, but somewhere else.
It starts, interestingly, in the realm of myth with a cosmic backstory, really.
Yeah.
It centers on this sentient stone.
A stone.
Yes, a leftover piece from when the goddess Nua was repairing the heavens. This stone, it witnesses everything, but feels this intense longing to experience human life, the joys, the sorrows, all of it.
And it gets its wish.
It does. It's allowed to descend to the mortal world and is incarnated as our protagonist, Jia Baoyu. He's born into this incredibly wealthy Jia family, and remarkably, he has a piece of magical jade in his mouth when he's born.
Wow. A literal piece of his origin.
A direct link, yes. But here's the twist, the karmic element. Before its descent back in the heavens, this stone had shown kindness to a particular plant, the crimson pearl flower. It had nurtured it.
Okay.
And this flower felt indebted. It vowed that if they both experienced mortal life, it would repay the stone's kindness with a lifetime's worth of tears.
A debt of tears. That sounds ominous.
It is, because that crimson pearl flower becomes incarnated as Lin Daiyu, the woman Baiyu, is destined to love.
So their central love story is its prescripted tragedy,
mm-hmm.
based on repayment through suffering.
Essentially, yes. The cosmic setup guarantees this deep connection, but also immense sorrow. It's quite profound.
Okay, so we have the cosmic origin, the karmic debt. Now let's ground ourselves in the human world. The Jia family, when we first meet them, they're at their peak.
Absolutely, Zenith. Wealth, power, influence, and the heart of their world, especially for the younger generation, is the Grand View Garden.
Tell us about the garden. It sounds idyllic.
It truly is. It was initially built extravagantly for a one-time visit by Baiyu's elder sister, who had become an imperial concubine, a huge honor.
So a symbol of their status.
Exactly. But after she leaves, this stunning, custom-built park becomes a sort of enclosed paradise for Baiyu and his female cousins. It's beautiful, filled with nature, poetry, art, a world shielded from the pressures and corruptions outside.
A kind of bubble, then. A beautiful one, but still.
A golden cage, as you put it earlier. Yes. It's this haven of youthful innocence and artistic pursuits, but its existence is entirely dependent on the family's fortunes, which, as we know, are already starting to fray at the edges, even if it's not obvious inside the garden yet.
And this theme of illusion, it crops up early on, even for Baiyu.
Yes, crucially. In a famous sequence, Baiyu has a prophetic dream where he visits the land of illusion.
The land is illusion.
And there, he's shown these cryptic registers, like poems, that foretell the tragic destinies of many of the young women in his life, the very ones he cherishes in the garden.
So even in this supposed paradise, the seeds of tragedy are already sown. He gets a glimpse of the end.
He does. It introduces this powerful sense of impermanence right away. You're meant to appreciate the beauty of the garden, the youth, the poetry, but always with this underlying melancholy, this knowledge that it can't last.
That really sets the tone. Okay, let's focus on the people living out this destiny, the three central figures in this, well, this tragic love triangle.
Right. First, there's Jiabayu himself, the boy born from the stone. He is, well, he's completely out of step with his time and his social class. He's deeply sensitive, artistic, incredibly empathetic, especially towards women. He absolutely despises the Confucian path expected of him, studying for exams, aiming for a government career,
He
statecraft.
rejects the system.
Completely. He has this famous saying, women are made of water, men are made of mud. He genuinely believes women are spiritually purer, more refined, closer to some kind of essential truth than men obsessed with power and status.
That must have made him quite an anomaly in that patriarchal
A
society.
huge one. And it puts him constantly at odds with his family, especially his father. His journey is really one from this kind of naive idealism towards, well, towards something else entirely by the end.
We'll get to that. Now, Lin Dayu, the crimson pearl flower, here to cry her debt of tears.
Yes, Dayu. She is Bayu's soulmate in every sense. Incredible intelligence. Her poetic talent is maybe unparalleled in the novel, but she's defined by her fragility, both emotional and physical.
Why fragile?
She's an orphan living in the Jia household, always feeling like an outsider. Her health is poor, often related to consumption. Her love for Bayu is absolute, consuming, but it's plagued by insecurity, jealousy, these intense bouts of sorrow. She literally weeps constantly.
Fulfilling her vow.
Exactly. She cries over falling blossoms, over perceived slights from Bayu, over the sheer precariousness of her position and their love. Her life is the repayment of that tearful debt. It's quite heartbreaking to witness.
And then, completing the triangle, we have Xue Baochai. How does she fit in?
Paochai is the perfect counterpoint to Dayu. If Dayu is all volatile emotion, authenticity, and artistic brilliance, Baochai is poise, pragmatism, and social grace.
The ideal Confucian woman.
Precisely. She's calm, rational, always appropriate, incredibly well-liked, especially by the elders in the family. She represents stability, duty, the kind of wife the Jia clan needs to maintain its social standing.
And there's a physical element to this match too, isn't there? With the jade.
Yes, that's crucial. Baochai possesses a golden locket given to her by a monk that bears an inscription, and society, or at least the family elders, see this locket as the destined match for Baoyu's jade. It's like fate's seal of approval on their union.
So it's jade versus gold, passion versus propriety.
Exactly. This isn't just about young love. It's a fundamental conflict between individual desire, represented by Baoyu and Dayu's connection, and the demands of social duty and clan survival, represented by Baochai.
And Dayu, with her intensity and her outsider status, she just doesn't fit the family's requirements.
Not at all. They need alliances, stability, heirs. Baochai offers all of that. Dayu offers, well, sublime poetry and a love that challenges the very foundations of their world.
While this emotional drama unfolds in the garden, the whole structure supporting it is crumbling. And a key figure accelerating that collapse is Wang Xifeng, right? Spicy Phoenix.
Ah, Xifeng, what a character. She's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and terrifyingly competent. She manages the huge, complex Jia household.
But she's also corrupt.
Utterly. She's shrewd, capable, charismatic even, but ruthless. She wields her power for personal gain, and her actions are a major factor in the family's financial ruin.
How specifically? What's she doing? Because this feels like more than just a character flaw, it's a critique of the system itself.
It absolutely is. Her main crime, really, is running an illicit money lending operation, basically. Usury, using the family's resources and reputation. She charges exorbitant interest rates, exploits vulnerable people, including relatives and servants.
Right, from inside the mansion.
Yes. And she's utterly ruthless in collecting debts, even contributing to people's deaths to protect her schemes. Her greed and lack of any real moral compass show the rot within the system. She maintains this facade of perfect management, but she's poisoning the family from the inside out.
A microcosm of the wider decay. So the family's finances are wrecked, enemies are circling, Dayu is seen as unsuitable, the elders feel they have to act decisively.
They do. The matriarchs, Grandmother Jia and Lady Wang, increasingly favor the stable, sensible Baochai. They see her as the only way to secure Baoyu's future, and by extension, the family's dwindling hopes.
But Baoyu is devoted to Dayu. How do they manage it?
Through a truly cruel deception. It's the turning point, the climax. First, something happens to Baoyu's jade, it gets stolen.
The magical jade from his birth.
Yes. And losing it throws him into a state of confusion, almost delirium. He's mentally and physically compromised, disconnected from his core self, you could say.
And they exploit this state.
They do. They tell him he's going to marry his cousin Lin. He, in his compromised state, naturally assumes they mean Lin Daiyu, his love.
Oh, no.
But they arrange the entire lavish wedding ceremony for him to marry Xuepai. He goes through with it, believing he's marrying Daiyu, too unwell and confused to realize the truth until the very last moment.
The manipulation is just breathtakingly cold.
It leads directly to the devastating climax, what's often called the double tragedy. Bayou's wedding ceremony, full of music and celebration.
It happens at the exact same time as Daiyu's death.
Yes. Daiyu, isolated in her quarters, hears the wedding music. She learns definitively of the betrayal. Realizing her earthly purpose, the repayment of tears is complete. She does one final heartbreaking thing.
She burns her poems.
Every single one. All the verses she wrote, often shared with or inspired by Baoyu. It's like she's erasing the testament to their spiritual connection, severing the ties. And then, utterly alone, consumed by grief and her illness, she dies.
While Baoyu is marrying someone else under false pretenses.
And the reveal is instantaneous. He lifts the bridal veil, expecting Daiyu, and sees Baochai. The shock, the horror, it snaps him back to reality, but it's a reality shattered beyond repair.
Yeah.
Just inconsolable grief.
That moment, it feels like the point of no return, not just for him, but for the whole family.
It absolutely is. The tragedy of the lovers signals the final collapse. Soon after, the hammer falls.
Yeah.
Imperial guards raid the Jia mansions.
Why? Political reasons? Financial crimes?
A combination. Political enemies, the exposure of their mismanagement, perhaps even Xi Feng's shady dealings catching up. Everything is confiscated. The family is ruined.
And what happens to the key figures? Wang Xifeng.
Xi Feng dies disgraced, abandoned. Her machinations brought her power, but ultimately led to ruin. A fitting end, perhaps, showing the fate of unchecked greed within that system. The matriarch dies of grief.
And the Grand View Garden, the paradise.
It falls into ruin, overgrown, abandoned, the perfect symbol of the transience of worldly glory, all that beauty, wealth, and power. Just gone, like a dream.
But Baiyu's story doesn't end quite there, does it? He survives the initial shock.
He does. He's lost everything, but there's a sense that he's also learned something profound. He actually fulfills one final duty to the clan. He manages to pass the Imperial Civil Service exams, the very thing he always resisted.
Really? After everything?
It's almost like a final detached gesture. But soon after, he experiences a kind of spiritual awakening. He has visions, encounters the Buddhist monk and Taoist priest who facilitated his journey to the mortal world in the first place.
The ones from the very beginning.
The very same. They essentially help him see the illusory nature of everything he experienced. The love, the loss, the wealth, the suffering. It was all part of the stone's journey, the necessary dream it had to live through to gain enlightenment.
Enlightenment.
So what does he do?
He makes a radical choice. He leaves. He walks away from his ruined family, leaves Baochai, who is pregnant, adding another layer of complexity, and vanishes into the snow.
Vanishes.
To become a wandering monk.
Yeah.
He renounces the world entirely, completing his cycle, returning in essence to his origin as that detached, enlightened stone.
That ending is so powerful, but also ambiguous, isn't it? Is it a tragic escape, abandoning his responsibilities? Or is it the ultimate spiritual triumph?
That's the question the novel leaves you with. It resists easy answers. And it forces you to think about the nature of reality, attachment, and enlightenment.
It brings us back full circle to that core philosophical idea. The couplet Baiyu saw in the Land of Illusion. Can you remind us of that? Yes, the most famous lines, essentially. When falseness is taken for truth, truth becomes falseness. When nothing is taken for something, something becomes nothing. Or a common translation. Truth becomes fiction when the fiction's true. Real becomes not real where the unreal's real.
So the incredibly detailed real life depicted is ultimately the fiction or dream. But that dream is also the only truth we experience.
Exactly. It suggests our lived reality with all its intensity and beauty and pain is like a dream. But that dream is profoundly meaningful. It's the substance of our existence. The novel captures this bittersweet quality, appreciating the beauty, precisely because it's transient.
It leaves you with this deep sense of melancholy, but maybe also wisdom.
I think so. A wisdom about impermanence, about letting go.
It really drives home that life's most beautiful moments, like the days in the garden, are precious because they don't last.
And that true understanding, perhaps, comes from accepting that all great feasts must inevitably come to an end.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.